I'm delighted to welcome you today to our Cornell Genetic Ancestry Reveal event. This has been a very exciting and intense past couple months, and today you're going to get a chance to sort of learn something about what we and what some of the Cornell undergrads have learned about their genetic ancestry. So the project is really a joint effort, I should emphasize, between myself here at Cornell and also with Dr. Spencer Wells, director of the Genographic Project, Explorer in Residence, and also a Frank Rhodes Class of 56 visiting professor here at Cornell. He stays on West Campus when he's here. And in fact, has been a really remarkable sort of opportunity to bring the kind of work that he's done in public engagement into essentially the university community in a very engaging way. So why focusing on genetics? Genetics is something that is a lot of people hear about. They hear about genomes. They hear about, in fact, variation in individuals and things. But many people don't really understand what genetics is, what you can learn from it, what the limitations are, how, in fact, one can go from basically an instruction manual of 3 billion letters, of only 4 letters, to actually encode for the complexities of proteins and the building blocks of individuals that lead to phenotype, or the humans that exist today. And this is one of the really sort of forefronts of the life sciences and science in general today, is in fact decoding this complex orchestration of all this cellular development and so forth that results in an individual. Much of the interest is also in terms of understanding the differences that one finds in the genes and how it relates to differences in phenotype, including disease state, resistance to parasites or pathogens or drugs and things of that nature. So one of this is the things that certainly I believe very strongly is that it's not only people that study genetics that need to understand this information, but really all individuals need to understand it, because genetics is going to become part of the fabric of our life very quickly. It's already becoming part of the fabric of many people's lives. But there are many aspects about genetics that offer challenges and things. And this was really the motivation behind having a Cornell Genetic Ancestry Project. It was fundamentally an educational opportunity. It was an opportunity to, in fact, engage through participation. There's nothing like actually getting involved in something to make you want to learn more about the underlying principles and what the limitations and challenges are. We also wanted, in fact, to help the students and the community at large, and you'll hear a little bit about that, learn and engage in a number of key questions. First off, what is DNA? Why is it important to understand something about DNA? What can you learn from variation in DNA that exists? Why do some have objections to DNA testing? What are those objections? And in fact, understanding to make your own decisions. And then how can DNA testing actually improve the quality of your life? How can it impact medicine? How can it impact diagnoses, and how can it impact treatments, things like cancer treatments and targeting particular medications to more effectively deal with individual diseases. We chose to focus on genetic ancestry here for a very simple reason. One is the challenges with doing genetic testing for anything medically relevant of undergrads. The second is that almost everybody's curious about their ancestry. They're curious about, are the stories they heard from grandparents and aunts and uncles about where their relatives came from. You know, can they see, in fact, any signatures of some of those stories? And some students don't have a history. They were adopted. Or, in fact, their parents or grandparents were adopted, and so they don't really know for sure what their ancestry, in fact, is. So Cornell's a global institution. It's a remarkably diverse institution, and our sort of locations of many Cornell-associated campuses and things scatter across the world. The question, of course, is what would DNA reveal about our students' ancestries? Students come from all over the world to study here, the Cornell undergrads. This motivated Spencer and I to actually think about a project that they had done a few years ago of sampling 200 random individuals at a street fair in Queens, New York. And in fact, from that, those results, they basically found every major human genetic lineage. The question is, if we truly take a random sample at Cornell, would we in fact get that kind of picture? Now, before I talk a little bit about the specifics, let me simply mention that really what we're doing is looking at the histories of families. These are all a collection of families, two parents and their four children. Only one of the children has children again with another individual and so forth. And down through time, populations are simply collections of families. If you start at the bottom and go up, we all have two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and so forth. But an interesting feature of genetics over time is that if you take and strip away the genealogies of individuals, if you just focus on these five that we sample, we actually see they all trace back to a single common ancestor in the past. Over time, mutations occur on these branches and lead to the accumulation of DNA differences between. And in fact, so it's looking at these DNAs that allow us to infer something about this history. And that's the focus of what we tried to do. Our goal was to essentially randomly sample 200 individuals. We did it by email. We set up we randomly sent out emails for roughly 4,000 undergrads, had a website that opened on the 30th of January, and essentially within 14 minutes had 116 people signed up. They came February 1st to an event here at Cornell, and again, they were chosen randomly. They lined up. They were basically given information about informed consent and so forth. They were also given information about whether to choose their Y or mitochondrial DNA, things that Spencer will talk about. And then, in fact, they engaged in swabbing, which is basically scraping the inside of your cheek lightly. Those samples are then put in a small tube, sent off to a lab where the DNA is isolated from those samples of your cheek cells, analyzed by high-throughput DNA sequencers to get readouts of DNA sequences, in this case of four different individuals. And it's these sequences that fundamentally we're looking at in each of these things down here. All this testing was done in collaboration and partnership with Genographic. And it was through that really the test results emerged from this. What I want to do now is turn to a project that's been carried out by Marilyn Ripchin's documentary film class, in which they've picked up on a lot of the threads that have come from this project. And this is a very much a class in progress, but they put together a 10-minute clip that talks to some of the students that were involved in this, and I think you really enjoy it, because it also talks about some of the controversies and some of the issues that come up. It doesn't talk about the results today. That'll come next with Spencer. But let's go to the video clip, and I hope you'll enjoy.
Well, I know I have just African American in my background.
Irish, German, Scottish.
I'm from Singapore.
Irish.
Basically all my ancestors are German as well.
As you can see, I'm Asian, I'm Chinese.
I'm very, very proud of my Jamaican ancestry.
About a quarter Italian and a quarter German.
All of mankind almost came from like a specific location or a specific spot. Something like this kind of shows how everyone sort of came from almost the same part of the world or the same community, and they branched out like that.
So in a way, people are connected, but at the same time, I think that to some degree, it's a little bit more vague.
Sometimes it's nice to be in a little bubble where you think that you're different. I'm not sure why that would be a good feeling to have, because I guess it's the nature of humans to want to be connected and be social. So, I don't know, it's really weird that I have that feeling.
Hopefully, you know, there's a lot of history of thinking like there's a genetic basis to race and maybe helping to overcome that. In the end, it's something that's really difficult to overcome. I think like each generation makes some sort of progress towards being more interconnected, but not completely.
So I'm often asked, okay, we buy this kit or we sign up for this kit, and somebody swabs my cheek outside, what am I going to find out? What are you actually going to be able to tell me? Well, again, it's about your deep ancestry. It's not about who your cousin Louis was related to or whatever, whether you're related to a famous person in history. Although in some cases, Genghis Khan, that's another story, we can actually say something about that. But again, it's your deep ancestry, your ancient journey from an African homeland
to wherever your indigenous ancestors came from most recently. By looking at the patterns of genetic variation in people from all over the world, sequencing DNA, lining up the sequences, looking at the positions where they vary, single nucleotide polymorphisms, as we call them, we've been able to construct trees, family trees, for everybody alive today.
Okay, so I can take you through how you'll go ahead and swab your cheek. So you have these two swabs here, but this is the end that you'll put into your mouth and scrub against your cheek for about 30 to 60 seconds. And in a couple seconds, I'll hand you one of these containers, put the swab into the container and press down with your thumb, and this should just drop off, and you'll be able to cap it, and then you can throw away the stick portion.
Any ideas about your ancestry?
Not really. I think maybe a little Native American, not quite sure.
Well, the AIP put out a statement in opposition to the project. What the Ancestry Project does is it takes swabs from everyone. It determines, you know, what parts of the world your ancestors may have come from. And, of course, its premise is we all came from Africa originally. I don't necessarily have any quarrel with that whatsoever. And then wended our way into various parts of the world and accumulated this ancestry. Our problem with this is that to focus diversity on this absolutely overlooks the social, political level of diversity, which at Cornell is represented by the American Indian Program and the Ethnic Studies programs, and thereby overlooks all the important issues that actually have to do with race and ethnicity in the United States, because they're social and political issues. This is a kind of diversity that actually winds up showing us how we're not diverse at all, right? Because we're all made up of so many different components, genetic components, population-wise, that in the end, what difference does it make whether someone is Native American or African American or you're American, Asian American? Because it cuts through all those definitional categories.
What it indicates is a fact, and the fact is that we have the genomes of all living humans are remarkably similar to each other. And the reason is that we have spread around the world in a fairly recent period of time. And there are certain lineages that trace us back. It doesn't mean we're the same at all. There's dramatic differences in culture and language and other things. And in fact, what's remarkable is how many different languages, how many different cultures and things have emerged in this period of time.
The geographic, quite unconsciously, I guess, is claims that they're collecting this genetic material from indigenous peoples because they're in the face of their potential disappearance. There are 300 million of them in the world, so they're not disappearing.
You know, many times in my school, I have students that are of different ethnic backgrounds than I am, and they think that we're very different. So I think it'll be intriguing to see when you trace things back, we all really are, we're definitely related, and I think they'll find it interesting when I tell them that I might be related to them or to Great Aunt Bessie.
Oh yeah, I was showing the video, the human family tree, last week, and one girl, when she, there's a part in the video where they talk about the fact that we're all related and we all basically have ancestors from a small family or a single person in Africa. She exclaimed and she asked, so are we related, meaning her and I? And I said, yes, and she goes, and we all came from Africa? And I said, yes, and she was so excited about that. She said, can I call my mom, like, right now? But it was, you could just see the revelation in her eyes. It was beautiful. It was great.
Because it's a way to see what you can do with science and technology. Instead of just, like, what you learn in the classroom, this is applying it to a situation. It's like doing a science project, and you can, like, see the results, and you can see what's happening. And it's also because it is such a big project, you can see that everyone else is looking at it, that there are these big effects. And I think that it makes you feel like part of something bigger. So for a student who is struggling, who is going to an alternative school, it makes them feel like they're important in some way, you know, and that they can see that, you know, that you could be doing this one day. You could be doing something that can have an effect on a large number of people. So I definitely think it's very important.
I have this passion about wanting to see virtually every student that graduates from Cornell come out of here. I mean, you know, we have to take a swim test. Well, I think we ought to know something about what genetics means for us and things. It's just as important as knowing how to swim, because it's going to help you potentially improve the quality of your life and understand what the limitations are of it as well. So.
Well, I would hope that it would make them see that we are similar, that we are all related. You know, I think you're more likely to be friends with somebody that you know, and if you know that you're related to everybody, maybe we'll all be friendlier to each other. I don't know.
If Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were real people, if yes. they did exist, then I am directly, you know, I am yes. their son's son. That's kind of neat.
That's cool.
I like that. I like that. It gives me sort of a more direct Jewish connection in that way. No, it's funny too, because I mean, as you mentioned, the tradition is that religion flows from the mother.
Mm-hmm.
From what I know of my mother's ancestry, if I were to do the same test with mitochondrial DNA, I probably would get no Jewish linkage whatsoever. So, who are you going to listen to? You know?
Right.
Direct paternal descent from Abraham, Isaac,
yeah,
and Jacob,
we can brand it against
or
the database.
Completely non-Jewish mother?
Let's see who you're closest to.
Yeah.
Because we think we have a signature for Abraham.
Mm-hmm. That is neat.
You should run that for sure.
Yeah.
How do I get that done?
I can do it for you.
Cool. Okay.
I just think it's awesome how we're all linked somehow. Like, the further back you go, the further connected you are.
And it's like I feel this instant connection that I feel like needs to be there. But I don't know how to describe it other than it just feels right.
Great work, guys. Wonderful film. Well, it's wonderful to see so many people showing up again to hear us talk about genetics, and in particular the results of the Cornell Genetic Ancestry Project. How many students who were swabbed actually came back? Raise your hands. Okay, fantastic. We've got 40 or 50 in the audience. Wonderful. Welcome back. And hopefully you've all checked your results online. Have you checked the results online? Yes? No? Very good. Okay, so we're going to talk about that in a minute. So, Chip did a wonderful job of introducing the project and what it is we were aiming to do in this huge effort. And I just want to go through a little bit of the science and then talk about some of the results, which is why you're all really here. So again, this whole idea was inspired by something that we explored as part of the Genographic Project a couple of years ago, where, as Chip said, we went out to a street fair in Queens and swabbed 200 random people. And the goal of that was really to test a theory. The idea is that people have been diverging from an African ancestor, and we'll talk about the specifics of that in a minute, for 60,000 years or so, scattering to the wind all over the world, in the process generating the patterns of diversity we see in indigenous groups, if you will, around the world today. And if you could rewind back 500 years or so, you would see those even to a more extreme extent. But the idea is that in the last few hundred years, people have been moving around and mixing to a much greater extent than we ever have in human history. And so we're creating these melting pot cities, like New York, like Queens in particular, arguably the most diverse part of the most diverse city on Earth. So there are people speaking 150 different languages living in Queens, and they, more than half of them, are foreign born. So many people today are really kind of mutts. I'm a mutt. Many of you are probably mutts. We have ancestors from all over the world. We're Heinz 57. And so the goal was to see, can you actually pick up most of the world's major genetic lineages in one potentially interbreeding population? And the result for Queens was, yes, we could. And we wanted to see if that was possible here at Cornell, because Cornell is an incredibly diverse place. Now, just as a reminder to reiterate some of the stuff that Chip said, we're studying DNA as a tool to track these ancient human migratory routes to construct the family tree for everybody alive today. DNA, a long linear molecule composed of billions of subunits, we call them nucleotides, A, C, G, and T, and it's the sequence of these nucleotides that provides a blueprint to make another version of you, Okay, and it's a lot of information, and every generation you have to copy it to pass it on. So your parents had to do that to pass on their DNA to you, and they got theirs from their grandparents and so on. So it traces an unbroken line of descent back in time through the generations. But because there's so much information, on occasion as it's being copied, being passed down through the generations, you get little typos, little spelling mistakes. We call them mutations at the genetic level. They don't occur very often, a rate of around 100 per genome, all the billions of nucleotides in your genome, 100 per genome per generation, ticking off at a clock-like fashion. Okay? Now, if you inherit one of these markers from someone in the past, and you share it with another person, that means you share ancestry, the person who first had that change in their DNA. And so that's how we connect people up into ever deeper branches of the human family tree, by looking at the pattern of markers and the phylogenetic relationship, to use a technical scientific term, but in effect, constructing family trees for both our maternal side, mitochondrial DNA, as it's called, and the Y chromosome, the male equivalent. So the take-home message of all of this work, as we alluded to in the film, is that the deepest branches on the human family tree trace us back to Africa. Okay? These deep branches are only found in African populations. And because the length of the branches is proportional to the number of changes that have occurred over time, that means that Africans have been accumulating this mutational diversity for longer than any other group. Therefore, our species originated in Africa. Now, since the time of Darwin, people have kind of talked about we originated in Africa because, as Darwin suggested, you know, there are apes that are kind of like us living there. So if you go far enough back in time, millions of years, tens of millions of years perhaps, we're related to chimps and gorillas back in the African continent. And physical anthropologists as recently as a generation ago probably would have guessed, you know, probably we came out of Africa, but a million years ago at least. Maybe Homo erectus left and gave rise to all the races, in quotes, around the world. But there are deep-seated biological differences between these groups that have accumulated over millions of years. But what's clear from the genetic analysis is how recently we share that African origin. Not millions of years ago, but as recently as 60,000 years ago. 2,000 human generations. So it's only in the last 2,000 generations that we have scattered to the wind to populate the entire planet, in the process of generating these branches on the human family tree that shows how we've made the journey. So what did we find out from the branches that we found in the Cornell population? Well, this is an overall summary of the genetic lineages we found, sorted according to regional affiliation. So again, everybody traces back to Africa within the last 60,000 years, both Africans and non-Africans. But, as I said, we've accumulated additional changes since some of us started to leave Africa. And the overall picture is incredibly diverse. In fact, it's at least as diverse as the sample we took in Queens. Random sample, 200 Cornell undergraduates. So for instance, Native American lineages, these are primarily mitochondrial DNA lineages, around 5% of the population, mostly Hispanic individuals. East Asians, typically East Asian lineages, around 14%. Africans, around 5%. Europeans, slightly more than half. South Asians, South/Central Asians, around 11%. And Middle Eastern lineages, about 8%. And a lot of these are also found in Europe, but they're at highest frequency in the Middle East. So you can pat yourselves on the back. You're a really diverse group of students. Well done. Now, I just want to show you a couple of examples of some of the lineages that we found. So this is mitochondrial DNA haplogroup M. Any haplogroup M's out in the audience? Want to stand up or raise your hands? Okay, so we've got several people out there. So this is a lineage that, as with every other lineage, started off in Africa. And then starting around 60,000 years ago, started to leave Africa along a coastal route, the south coast of Asia. These would have been people beachcombing their way through India down into Southeast Asia, reaching Australia by around 50,000 years ago. So this lineage is found at high frequency in the Australian Aborigines. Found scattered throughout the islands of Southeast Asia and all the way over in East Asia as well. So it is a very typically Asian, primarily Southern and Southeastern Asian lineage, as well as Oceanian. And so it delineates that earliest migration from Africa through Asia, the south coast of Asia in particular. Another example, haplogroup H. Anybody haplogroup H? Should have lots of those. Yep. The most common mitochondrial DNA lineage in Europe. Around half the women in Europe are members of haplogroup H, the most popular girl in class, so to speak. As with everybody else, you started off in Africa, migrated out of Africa into the Middle East around 45 to 50,000 years ago. This was an inland migration. Your ancestors moved west into Europe during the Upper Paleolithic, when we're all still living as hunter-gatherers, so the Cro-Magnon people, moving into Europe between 20 and 30,000 years ago, encountering the Neanderthals, driving them to extinction by around 25,000 years ago. This is during the last ice age, and you've got these encroaching ice sheets up to the north, and we reached the last glacial maximum, where pretty much all of Britain and all of Scandinavia covered in ice sheets, and this part of northern Europe is pretty much uninhabitable, so people were forced to the south. They headed for the beach, which we do in the winter. Made sense. And the ancestors of haplogroup H, as well as R1b, any Y chromosome R1bs, similar story, headed down into Spain, and they overwintered the worst part of the last ice age. The ice sheets retreat starting around 15,000 years ago, and as they did, your haplogroup H ancestors and R1b repopulated northern Europe, the most successful group of people in Western Europe. So pretty cool story. This is kind of an interesting one. It really kind of verges into more recent events in history, haplogroup R1a1. So that same exit from Africa 45 to 50,000 years ago, turning eastward into Central Asia and westward into Europe, around 35,000 years ago, the ancestors of R1b who made it over here and hung out with haplogroup H down in Spain. But some of these guys stuck around over in the steppe lands, or maybe further east and south in Central Asia, but somewhere in this steppe grassland zone. Around 15,000 years ago, the defining marker for R1a, a marker we call M17, originated. And today, this lineage is scattered all the way from Eastern Europe down into northern India at very high frequencies, 50, 60% in Ukrainian and Russian populations, 40% in northern Indian populations. Why is it so widespread? Well, because we believe that people who belong to R1a were among the first to domesticate the horse, and also among the first speakers of Indo-European languages. And today that language family is scattered all over Europe and down into India and Iran, probably carried by these nomadic horsemen over the last 5 to 10,000 years. So again, a really cool story. Anybody R1A out there in the audience? One? Yeah, so this is a typically central or what we might call South Asian lineage. So really cool story. But there are lots of other stories. And to help me tell these stories, I want to invite a couple of people up on stage. So we've got Mackenzie Malia, if you could come up. And we've got Emil Chang, if you could come up too. Have a seat. And Chip, you can come on up. Now, we're going to get to Mackenzie and Emil in a second, but first, we want to get somebody on the phone. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today. He is representing Cornell at the National Forensics Finals in debate. So this is Daniel Klein. He agreed to let us use his story even if we couldn't get him on the line. He's supposed to be hopping on a plane, as I said, so maybe the plane's left early. Maybe he's lucky. So Dan turned out to be a member of one of these Middle Eastern genetic lineages. So he tested his Y chromosome. And his Y chromosome, and he belongs to haplogroup J1. Now, the reason I say it's Middle Eastern is because more than 90% of the J1s are found in Middle Eastern populations, very high frequencies in the Arabian Peninsula, over 70% there, also in other places in the Middle East. And it delineates, of course, that second expansion out of Africa into the Middle East 45 to 50,000 years ago, people who stuck around there for a long time. And then they were also among the first farmers. So beginning around 10,000 years ago, they probably originated somewhere over in this region. They expanded to the south, down into Ethiopia and places in northeastern Africa, down into the Arabian Peninsula, and out into North Africa. So it's primarily, as I said, a Middle Eastern genetic lineage. But we do see it occasionally in European populations. And Dan has told us, he was actually quite surprised when we had the reveal event for the 200 people who swabbed, a private event on Sunday, that he thinks of himself as being European. Now, he's Ashkenazi Jewish, but he, again, thinks of himself primarily as being European. And what I told him was that haplogroup J is not limited to the Middle East. It's also found in Ashkenazi Jewish populations in Europe, and that is as a result of the Jewish diaspora. Now, he was really curious about this, and you saw him in the film. He was talking about the Abrahamic lineage and so on, and he wanted to know what additional information we could gather by comparing him to the database. And it turns out that he is a member of a subtype or subset of J1s known as J1C3D. Now, this is a lineage that originated most likely in the northern part of the Fertile Crescent in the Middle East between 5 and 6,000 years ago. And it spread throughout the Fertile Crescent and down into the Arabian Peninsula over the last few thousand years. And today it's found at high frequency in Jews in the Middle East and Ashkenazi Jews in Europe. Around 15% of European Jews are members of J1C3D. But also the Adnani Arab tribes, and these are the northern Arabs. Now, Muhammad was actually a northern Arab. And data that hasn't been published yet, but it's been collected in collaboration with an Arab genealogist. Genetic and genealogical data suggests that Muhammad was also part of this J1C3D lineage. Now, how does that work? How do we see it in both Jews and Arabs? Over 70% in some of these Adnani Arab tribes. Well, the Adnani Arabs take their name from Adnan. And looking back through the stories in the Quran and in the Torah, Adnan was the son of Ishmael. And Ishmael was the son of Abraham, the oldest son of Abraham. And Ishmael is generally considered by the Quran to be the founder of the Arab tribes. Now, the Jewish tribes trace their ancestry, of course, to Jacob, also known as Yisrael. And he's the son of Isaac, the second son of Abraham. So that J1C3D lineage that's shared between the Adnani Arabs and the Jews is consistent with this story. It doesn't prove the story in the Bible or the Torah, but again, it's entirely consistent with that. And it's very interesting that as we gather more information, very high-resolution genetic information, we're starting to confirm some of these stories that we hear about from myths, religious texts, and so on. So it's a fascinating Y-chromosome lineage. Okay, now we come to you, Mackenzie. Now, we told you that you're a member of mitochondrial DNA haplogroup A, which, as you can see from the map, came out of Africa 45 to 50,000 years ago, that inland migration, headed east. The markers that define haplogroup A originated probably somewhere in Central Asia. And today, A is found not only in Central and Eastern Asia, but also among the Native American groups in the New World. And so it was one of the founding lineages of the Native Americans. Now, does that make sense, given what you know about your family history?
Actually, it was quite surprising, because my father is European white, but my mother comes from, well, she does come from Bolivia, which is basically where that middle dot is. But her family, as far as she could tell, traveled to Bolivia from Spain a couple generations back. But as far as she knew, we didn't have any native Bolivian in us at all. So we weren't expecting it.
So how does it feel to have this connection to the Native American people in Bolivia?
I love it. I've always felt very connected to the Bolivian culture, which, and my family has been there for several generations anyway, but I like having another tie, more genetic tie.
Very cool. Okay, so this was a surprise, but a good surprise.
Definitely, yeah.
Great. And so now we come to you, Emil, and you had your mitochondrial DNA tested, yes, and so this is about your mom's side. And it placed you as a member of haplogroup L2, which is a very common lineage in Central and Western Africa. In fact, it delineates the earliest expansion from East Africa into this region of Africa, probably starting around 80,000 years ago. And you're actually a member of L2A, the particular sublineage of L2, which is very frequent in this part of West Africa and is the most frequent African-American lineage. So does that tend to agree with what you know about your mom's side of the family?
To tell you the truth, I have no idea about where my mom's side of the family comes from. She didn't know. She wanted me. That's exactly why she wanted me to become part of the project, because she herself wanted to find out about that side of the family. Because as we knew, we were just African-American slaves in Georgia and stuff like that. So okay. This is really surprising myself.
So it's a surprise, but not completely, perhaps.
Yeah, not a complete surprise, no.
Okay. Now, you also, it turns out, independently tested your Y chromosome.
Yes, I did.
Which is kind of cool. And that told a very different story, didn't
it?
Okay. So that's your Y chromosome story. So we have an exit from Africa via that inland route and people moving eastward through Central Asia. And among the earliest founders of the East Asian population, so not that coastal migration that came down through here, but one that was a little further to the north, haplogroup O, in a particular haplogroup O3, which is the most frequent lineage in Chinese populations. So Han Chinese, about 70% O3. Very common in Japanese populations, but also throughout Southeast Asia. And this lineage originated probably about 15,000 years ago. And it's expanded enormously since its origin, probably in southern China, due to the expansion, we believe, of rice agriculture. A wave of people washing over East Asia. And so that's your dad's side of the story, which is completely different. So does that fit into what you know about your ancestry?
Well, on my dad's side of the family, I'm more in tune with that because they always pass down the stories of the generations of how my great-grandfather, Chang'a King, came from China and moved to Jamaica, and that's where he met my great-grandparents. And, yeah, it's an interesting story. That's all I can really say about it. It's just really interesting because when I meet with people and they see my last name, Chang, they don't really expect to see someone of my color. I remember in high school, they was like, so Mr. Chang, we thought it was the Korean kid sitting next to me and everything. I'm like, no, I'm Emil Chang. He's Daniel Chang. We're not related, but well, we kind of are, but that's how it went.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, a good indicator of kind of the future, what's happening in America and around the world today. So people are mixing, as I said, to a much greater extent. And you've got people like Tiger Woods, who can't actually describe themselves as being a traditional race. He calls himself Kablan Asian, Caucasian, Black, Asian, because he's also a mix of people.
Yeah, I kind of like to refer to myself as Blasian, Black, and Asian. So that's my
wonderful, yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's really cool. Great story. Okay, so that was an introduction to, you know, some of the major
Hello,
languages.
Spencer.
Oh, Dan. Dan, I'm sorry. We already discussed your lineage. We'd love to get some feedback from you, though, on what you thought of the story.
What I thought of the story? Well, I got to say, I was pretty interested to hear it because I sort of thought that my ancestry was probably pretty typical to most other people of European origin around me, but I was rather astonished to find that my paternal lineage actually came from the Middle East, and more than that, apparently even from Abraham. It's pretty exciting to hear that you belong to a historically important lineage like that.
Yeah, no, it is a very historically important lineage. I mean, essentially the patriarch of the world's three great monotheistic religions. Certainly Judaism and Islam, but, you know, assuming that Christianity is really kind of a reformed Judaism, all three. Pretty impressive, huh? Does it change, you know, how you view yourself, and have you told your parents, too?
Well, I don't think it changes how I view myself, per se. I mean, I don't think I'm going to become more Jewish than I already am as a result. But it's
now you made a comment about a dietary choice in the email you sent me in response.
Sorry?
You made a comment about a dietary choice that you're not going to make in the email you sent.
Oh, well, you know, Orthodox Jews who keep kosher don't eat bacon, for instance, and I like bacon, so I eat bacon, and that's not going to change because I found out I'm a descendant of Abraham.
Love it. Now, how did the debate competition go, by the way?
Well, it hasn't started yet.
Oh, it hasn't?
We're going to get going tomorrow morning.
Okay. Well, we wish you luck. Thanks a lot for letting us call you, and I'm glad we could patch you through.
Thanks. I'm glad I caught you, too.
And if you want to stay on the line, we're going to take questions from the audience. I don't know if you have to run.
About how long is that?
Not too long. You can drop off whenever you want, but hopefully you'll be able to stick around. Thanks
okay.
again.
I'll stick around.
Okay, great. So, yeah. Again, that was the introduction. It takes a while to get back through these. To the main lineages. And if you want more information on the project, either here at Cornell or at Genographic, you can go to the websites. And with that, I'd like to open it up for questions and let you guys not only question me and Chip, but also, you know, any of the students who are up here. So thank you very much.
I will mention real quickly that, as I said this earlier, this has truly been an experiment in progress. I mean, the data has just rolled in the past literally week and a half, 2 weeks. It's been sort of a mad scramble to put this together, but a really exciting one. And in fact, many of the sort of results and stories are still emerging in emails to Spencer and myself about people who have their results and are now thinking about them. And so there'll be lots of things that are going to roll out over the next, the rest of this semester, and certainly next semester and next year as well. Certainly in some of the social sciences and things, they want to pick up on some of these conflict issues and some of the other type things. And it's, I think, a really good opportunity, much like the engagement of the documentary film class and so forth. And I just want to, again, offer my personal thanks, before we go to questions, to Marilyn, to, in fact, helping with the students to pull off this. This is one of many documentaries these students are doing this semester, and of course they have other classes as well. So they've done a great job. And I also want to thank, obviously, the other supporters that have provided financial and other support for this, and they're all listed on our website for that. But please check back with that. There'll be more things. There'll be more information about things as they roll out. There'll be some of the video clips. The documentaries will be available. There'll be a showing of those documentaries in May 8th. And in fact, as I said, this is really the beginning of a discussion of this and a dialogue that this has opened up, and we're just really thrilled. This is, importantly, this is the first time Genographic, there's ever been a partnering like this to do a random sampling of 200 undergrads at a university. And so I really appreciate all the interest and effort by the National Geographic staff, including Glennis and Colby here, who have really helped tremendously on this whole project. So, but questions now to Daniel or to these guys up here from you guys.
Over there.
Hello?
I just want to ask you this, where we can look at all of the trends, because I know I was tested and I didn't realize how different it was, like, one of the most popular European trends. Is this somewhere where you can, like, see, like, generally?
Yes, on our website, we have something called the Atlas of the Human Journey, and so you can click on that, and that shows, you know, it, like an atlas, you can click on all the different arrows and see how they connect with each other. Sure. Yeah. Those are related lineages. So again, to provide context, you're not kind of heading off on your own unrelated to anybody else. You're related to lots of people in that region and elsewhere in the world. So, you know, again, if you click on the atlas, you'll be able to see how you connect up with those other lineages. Yeah. That's a good question. We actually had two guys who came back as members of the C3 lineage on their Y chromosome, and that's what the Genghis lineage belongs to. Now, they didn't have the particular microsatellite haplotype signature that we see for Genghis. So they are related, but they're not in the direct line from him. They're like, you know, cousins, fourth cousins or something.
Did you get your Y chromosome tested, Ken?
Yeah.
Eric.
Now that you have this information, would you be willing to have your whole genome sequenced? Any of the people in the audience? I mean, in the front here, would that be something you would consider, or would you be more hesitant?
Oh, sorry, can you repeat the question again?
Now that you've been sort of genotyped for a few markers, would you actually, if you had the opportunity to have your whole genome sequenced, would you consider doing something like that, or would you think more carefully?
I probably would get the whole genome sequence just to know, just to see, just for curiosity reasons and everything, because I was always interested in genetics, and I've been actually been following the Genographic project for a while now. Like, I had got my Y chromosome tested, matter of fact, my freshman year, which was 2 years ago, because now I'm a junior. So, yeah, definitely would.
Yeah, I think I'd be interested in that, too. I mean, I'm already interested enough to want to know this part of my lineage, and to know a little more detail would be really fascinating. I mean, there might be some more surprises, so I would love it.
Daniel, are you still on the line?
I'm still on the line. Was there a question?
Yeah, would you, so the question is, having done this testing, would you be willing or interested in having your whole genome tested, looking at the other regions outside of your Y and MT DNA?
I think I would definitely be interested in having more tests done. I mean, this is sort of sparked my curiosity to know what more interesting treasures, you might say, are hidden in my genetic material. And I'm kind of excited by the possibility of learning more about the past that is encoded in us but happened before the written word. Definitely.
The gene for liking bacon, maybe? Sorry.
Do you have something to say about the social context when you go through the Delta time, like how there's so much racial conflict and such? Like, part of it was kind of described by the social science professors earlier in the day, but I don't think that's really settled or...
Yeah, no, and that was the idea that the film students wanted with that footage, was they wanted to set up the debate but not really come to a resolution, because it is something to be debated. You know, we feel very strongly that this is not the sum total of your identity by any means. It's not even the sum total of your genetic identity. It's less than 2% of your DNA. It's one aspect of who you are, though, of your genetic ancestry. And we hope that it, you know, will add to your sense of self but not replace anything. You know, so you may have a cultural belief in belonging to a certain group or whatever that might be, but you know, you also have these genetic connections that are very real and that are provable using scientific methodologies. So, you know, I think it's important to have both. You know, Chip, you...
Yeah, I think one of the other things I think this raises is the... and it's a very important point, is that in many of these discussions, even the term of ancestry or of kinship or things of this nature, race, ethnicity, have very different definitions for different people. For people who focus on the social science or political issues, they have a completely different sort of perspective about what those words mean. And in fact, Professor Chaffetz, you know, explained to me that certainly the idea of kinship, I mean, to a geneticist myself, I mean, kinship replies kin, your relatives and things in a genetic sense, in an actual parentage, grandparents, and so forth. But he pointed out that certainly for many Native Americans, kinship includes kinship to the earth, to the plants and animals and things like that, a much more inclusive kind of kinship. So I think one of the lessons that has emerged from this, I think is a very important one, is in fact how the same word can in fact mean very, very different things to different people. And that's those are, I think, valuable points to understand. And one of the goals of this is for people to, in the sciences and humanities, to start to understand how other people define these words and think about it, because these are valuable opinions to understand. I think it helps often resolve some of the differences, although they still are not interested in being involved as a group. As individuals, many Native Americans have actually chosen to identify or have been chosen to be involved in the Genographic Project. And
absolutely. And it's certainly absolutely not correct that we don't value cultural diversity. In fact, one of the core components to what we're doing at Genographic is what we call the Legacy Fund. And these are grants to preserve cultural diversity around the world. We've raised $3.5 million from the sale of the 400,000 plus kits that we've sold so far. And, you know, given out over 52 grants, $1.5 million is very much an ongoing grants program that will continue for many years into the future. So that's a huge part of what we do, because we feel that is really the essence of being human. It's the cultural diversity we've accumulated over tens of thousands of years, ways of adapting to the environment, figuring out, you know, how to sail off to remote Polynesian islands or live in, you know, minus 70 temperatures in Siberia or build spaceships and fly to the moon. I mean, these are incredible things we do, but they're all cultural. And so that really is who we are as a species. We adapt culturally. But genetically, underlying all of that, we're very closely related to each other.
When you guys were talking about O'Neill's results, you talked about like this one haplogroup that sort of spread throughout Asia 15,000 years ago, and you mentioned that like rice cultivation might have been related to that. I was just wondering if there are like other examples of where like cultural or like historical events sort of affected the spread of a particular group.
Yeah, so the question is about, talking about the O3 lineage in East Asia and the spread of rice agriculture, are there other examples where culture has led to the spread of genetic lineages? Yeah, tons of them. So I mentioned the horseback riding, in all likelihood leading to the spread of R1A1. J1 within the Middle East, spread by agriculture. J2, which is more northern, but related to J1, coming out of the Middle East with the spread of the Neolithic into Europe. We see that all over the place, the spread of the Bantu-speaking peoples in Central, Eastern, and Southern Africa, tied into not only an advanced farming society in Africa that originated around 3,000 years ago, but also the first people in Sub-Saharan Africa to figure out how to work iron. And so they had a huge cultural advantage over surrounding groups. So we see that all the time. And this is actually, you know, the subject of my latest book, Pandora's Seed, the idea that we've created a culture that is starting to mold us biologically, and we see evidence of adaptation in our genomes, so lactase persistence into adulthood, the idea that, you know, you've retained the ability to digest milk, even though the ancestral form is to lose that as you get older. And so every child is born able to digest that, but by the age of 2 or 3, when you're weaned, you lose that ability. That's been retained in some populations because they continue to drink milk into adulthood, and it was advantageous. So yes, we've very much adapted to the culture that we've created in the last 10,000 years, in some good ways and in some bad ways.
I would just simply add that if these are topics of interest to you, there are a wide variety of courses, and actually going to this the Cornell Center for Comparative and Population Genomics website, 3cpgep.cornell.edu, will actually give you an entree into many of the different courses and things that are available here at Cornell. In fact, part of this group from the center, in fact, 25 faculty from across campus, are in fact many of the leaders in developing a lot of the methods to understand these kinds of adaptations in the human genome, as well as in the response to selection in plants, domesticated plants, dogs, cows, horses, other kinds of things like that. So if you want to learn more about the science, there's a real good opportunity, and this is a wonderful place to, in fact, engage and get involved in those studies if you're interested. Yes.
Back up there.
You. Yeah. I'm curious, as students, now that you've been engaged with a project like this, have you become more interested in learning about the complexities of genetics and maybe where genetics and genomics is going to go in the future and how that might affect you?
Well, I always liked how we balance the genetics and the culture, because we still concentrate so much on culture. And I've always focused on that in my family. So I think now I'd want to, for example, I really would love my brother to get tested and see my father's side. But so I think now I'm going to be pulling in more of that genetic ancestry into what I already have in my cultural ancestry, or what I know. So yeah, I think it'll integrate itself into my life a little more.
Daniel, are you on the line?
I think he dropped off.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, go ahead.
After taking the after participating in the project, I'm more inclined to genetics. Just seeing how we can use genetics in order to see how our ancestral lines, our lineages are. I just want to see like where else can genetics bring us to, such as I'm trying to do an independent study about genetics and medicine, like. Hopefully, using genetics, we can discover which disorders are more prevalent in our like family, like genetic disorders, stuff like that, and see which medicines that we need to take. And yeah,
it's of interest to note that Daniel is signed off as a math and physics major, so he was somebody that hasn't really engaged in genetics that much at all, but unfortunately he signed off, so we don't know whether he's going to be learning more about genetics or not. I sense he will.
Yes, right here.
I think most of the T-Lex-Lady project only knows sort of general haplogroup they belong to, so if we wanted, how would we find out more?
Okay, there are two ways. If you want to pursue the kind of genealogical side, you want to see your very recent relatives and ancestors, you can opt into Family Tree DNA, their database. They're our partner. They do the testing for the public participation kits. We focused on the deeper ancestry, and they focused on the more recent events. And you can actually do this from your results page. The other thing is we are in the process of updating our website, and later this year you will be able to do that sort of thing on our website as well. So. Yeah, watch this space. But you basically have a subscription to your genome now, and as we learn more and as we improve our web experience, you'll be a part of that automatically.
In the very back.
Is the HAP A the only one that came to the Americas?
No, so there were four main founder lineages, A, B, C, and D, that are also found in Asia. And then there's a rare one known as haplogroup X, which is only found in North America, and then in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, two different sub-branches of X, X1 and X2. So there are kind of four main ones. One that's less frequent isn't found in South America, but the four main mitochondrial types, and then one Y chromosome, founder lineage in effect. Yeah, right here. Yeah, I mean, it's not something we're focusing on in terms of, you know, chimp diversity. Have we tried going beyond humans and looking at other species? There's a lot of work that's been done by evolutionary geneticists on relationships between chimps and humans, but we're not really focusing on chimp diversity. What we do, though, is when we discover these markers in our DNA to find out what the ancestral state and the derived states are, so the direction that evolution occurred in, we have to make comparisons to non-human primates. So that's how we use that data. But we're not really focusing on these events that happened 5, 10, 15 million years ago. Other people are, though. It's very interesting.
You said that this is less than 2% of the DNA. Does the other 98% have any information about geographical background, or is this 100% of the information about that?
No, it does, and we've recently figured out ways to start to tap into that information, and it's certainly something we're interested in pursuing in the future in the genographic project on a research side. But these are the most useful for tracking the migratory routes. Okay, but you can actually scan the rest of your genome and, you know, look at regional affiliations. And, you know, particularly if you're of mixed background, it's very interesting to see what percentages you are from these different groups. But these are the most useful markers for tracking the actual journeys, talking about the timing of the spread, and so on. Yeah, over here.
How many different types of groups do you have today, and are you expecting
these will expand? Well, that's a big question. I mean, it really depends on the level of resolution you want to get down to. There are potentially hundreds, maybe even over 1,000 haplogroups, but some of them are, you know, such fine-grained detail that they're only found in a single village or maybe even a single family, so they're not as useful. So it's really a question of how many do we have stories for, on the order of 200 to 300. Yeah. Yes. They're what we call neutral markers, and they're simply evolutionary baggage that's been passed down through the generations. They're markers of descent, so they tell us something about your ancestry. But they have no phenotype, no medical precondition, whatever that might be, associated with it.
One thing I would just add to that, there's certainly one of the reasons in this project, the Cornell Genetic Ancestry Project, we focused on partnering with the Genographic, is just what a good job they've done with this and all the ancestral paths. There certainly are other companies that sell various kinds of genetic testing. To us, one of the major goals of this was to educate you so you can make your own decisions. There is a push for many of the things, the genetic direct-to-consumer genetic testing that's available, to actually have that regulated by the FDA, and that'll probably happen within a fairly short period of time. There's a debate about whether you should be testing things yourself and then taking them to the doctors, because the doctors say, well, I don't know what lab did this and so forth. So the testing for medically relevant variants is in fact a very sort of much in flux thing. There are physicians that use certain targeted tests now quite routinely and so forth, certain kinds of breast cancers, other kinds of things of that nature. It's increasingly used in the diagnosis of particular tumor types to target chemotherapy and so forth. In fact, there's a lot of interesting aspects to learning about the different predispositions you have. But there's also a lot of challenges to understanding and interpreting that material. And one of the goals of this whole longer-term project is, in fact, to help students understand those different risks and the advantages, the pros and cons. How do you actually deal with the information that comes? And there's a whole move to really try to get the medical community much more engaged in using this information. With the prices of sequencing coming down, you can pretty much get what's called your total genome sequence now for sort of around $8,000 or so. It's not your 100% complete, but it's a fairly complete sequence. And certainly the expectation with this in a year or several years, it's going to be $1,000. And $1,000 is almost the cost of many current medical tests. So, in fact, it may be more sensible to get your whole genome sequenced and then with working together with your physician, and they can use that information to help decide, are there certain drugs you should or shouldn't take based on whether you metabolize drugs fast or slow or things of that nature. So it's really an emerging sort of field that touches on personal medicine and so forth, as well as the ancestry. As Spencer said, once you start looking into the rest of your genome, there's all sorts of other stories, but they can be more complex to interpret.
Okay, I think one last question right here.
Do you use any research from historians or archaeologists along with genetic testing to come up with reasons behind migratory routes, such as like the rice farming?
Absolutely. So what we can talk about with genetics is the who, where, and when, but without context, it's kind of meaningless. You know, you have some random people at some point in the past moving from point A to point B. Why am I interested in that story? So to provide the context, the how and the why, the really exciting stuff, you have to look at these other fields. And so we actually have a scientific advisory board for the project that includes people like Lord Colin Renfrew, who's one of the world's best practicing archaeologists, and Merritt Rulin, who's a linguist, and Meave Leakey, who's a paleoanthropologist, and so on. And so they and other colleagues help us to provide that context and fill in the story of, you know, how we did these amazing journeys around the world and why we were making the trips. So yeah, it's a very important part of it. Okay. Well, with that, I'd like to thank our participants, Mackenzie and Emil and Dan, who's dropped off, and all of you for coming out, and Chip and the whole team who was involved in this.
Yes, I certainly want to extend my thanks to Spencer and the National Geographic crew. The students have been involved, or just it's been fantastic. Many of them had exams tonight. It was a genetics exam, of all things, and other kinds of things. And so there's been a lot of students are off. This is one of the challenges of doing it at an academically rigorous university. The students are actually studying, so they know the results, so they don't want to. So, but it's in fact been really exciting with the engagement that they've had, and we certainly hope there'll be continued engagement. Outside, there are some of Spencer's books for sale. There's also the Genographic kits that are for sale that have been on sale at the campus store as well. And Spencer will be zipping out there and be out there on a table if you would like to get pick up a book and then have him sign it. He'd be more than happy to do that. So again, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, everybody.
Hey.